This episode is, in fact, brought to you by the good people at BundleRabbit.com, Earth's most accessible book bundling marketplace and distribution site. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 697.
Today, Ian asks,
a couple of months back on Writing Believable Geniuses, you mentioned being troubled by the Forrest Gump books, that you couldn't decide if the author displayed a bad attitude or was satirizing bad attitudes. I've had a similar experience recently rereading Robert Heinlein. I've concluded that Heinlein had to be tongue-in-cheek most of the time because he undermines himself so often, but I can also see how a lot of people ended up thinking he was a warmongering propagandist. Is this merely a first-world problem of success, or are there subtle ways to signal to the audience that you are actually not being serious? The essay Starship Stormtrooper springs to mind, but even more recently I reread The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, of which, bizarrely, I could only remember one line about Wyo being a surrogate mother. Man is such a dupe that I was relieved to come across reviewers who thought that Mycroft was playing him as much as the prof. I think even pre-Web Heinlein was a victim of haters who were skim readers, speed readers, and people who had heard of his stories second or third hand from speed readers, but I'm still most fascinated by how he ticked off people who on first glance seem like careful readers. As you know, I was almost a speed reader until recently, so if I got the joke...
Well, there's a few things going on here. First, you've got to keep in mind that there's two basic modes of reading. There's a few others, but for the purposes of this, there's two basic modes of reading. One is based on what philosophers call a hermeneutic of charity, which is that you read whatever you read, assuming the best possible motives on the part of the author, so that you give them the fairest shake you can. It's a philosophical thing, but it's something that some of us picked up from the environment we grew up in, and some of us didn't, because the other way of reading things is with a hermeneutic of suspicion, where you read things in order to find out what's wrong with them. And that's a mode of reading that people have been increasingly trained in the more education they get, especially since about the mid-60s. And there's a lot of philosophical reasons for that, involving the entrance of postmodernism onto the scene and the ascendance of literary criticism as a culture-forming discipline, and a whole bunch of other things, both legitimate and illegitimate, both psychological and sociological, that play into it. With regard to Heinlein, yeah, Heinlein loved pissing people off. If you read his corpus in its entirety, what you'll find is someone who, paradoxically seemingly, promotes and condemns authoritarianism, promotes and condemns war, promotes and condemns incest, promotes and condemns sexual liberation, promotes and condemns feminism. About the only thing he never appears to promote, actually that's not true. Read through a certain lens, he can even appear to promote and condemn racism. Heinlein the guy was a complicated figure, but the things that he was very, very much against were the victimization of the weak by the strong, weakness of character, particularly with regards to cowardice, a lack of integrity, and authoritarianism and prejudice. And he was very much, from the beginning, a feminist and anti-racist and all these other things. But Heinlein's interest as a writer was in, first, telling a good story, second, provoking the reader to think, and third, making characters that were really true in and of themselves. A couple of interesting things come out of that. First of all, as a fairly disagreeable fellow, and if you read biographies about him, accounts from people who knew him and liked him, as opposed to people who didn't like him, those emphasize this aspect of his personality much more. You'll find that he was a real grouch. He was a kind of hyper-reactive guy. He was set in his ways is not the right way of thinking about it. He had a very time and place dependent idea of the way people ought to behave, about what constituted good character. And it wasn't just about deep stuff, it was about surface level manners as well. And so he would, particularly as the culture changed around him, he became more and more prickly as the manners changed, and he frequently would interpret poor manners as a sign of poor character, or what he considered poor manners, when in fact he was failing to do the thing that his characters always preached that you should do, which is when in Rome. He was unable to make some of the adaptations that came with the cultural shifts between World War II and the 1960s. That caused him a lot of problems. Another thing that was going on a lot was fandom politics. And if you think fandom politics is bad now, go back and read what was happening between World War II and the early 1970s, because it was way worse. And as the fastest gun in the West, so to speak, he was one of the big four. Clark, Asimov, Bradbury, and Heinlein were the big four. As one of the big four, there were always young guys kind of trying to unseat him. The young guys, the new wave authors, most of them, Harlan Ellison aside, really hated him. They hated him personally, they hated him politically, they didn't get where he was coming from. And the fact that they so deeply identified with his kids' books as children set them up for a sort of, for a sense of betrayal when they came across his adult fiction, which is much more provocative. And when they met him personally and they discovered someone who by the 60s was chronically ill and really grouchy because, well, he was chronically ill because he had malaria his whole life and it got worse and worse and worse as he got older. But he was really grouchy because he'd had enough stalkers and fans taking advantage of him and publishers ripping him off and other stuff. And because he had that Southern gentleman ethic deep in his bones, he took all of that stuff personally in a way that people born later frequently didn't. Not that people don't take that stuff personally anymore, but they take it personally in a little bit of a different way. And all of these things together made him a polarizing figure, especially because of the difference between his writing for children and his writing for adults. The writing for children is very much designed to uplift and inspire, and the writing for adults is very much meant to criticize and provoke. And his adult novels are filled with characters who are fairly personally unpleasant. Even the good guys are fairly personally unpleasant and maybe a little bit nuts. And they are that way because, frankly, a lot of people are fairly personally unpleasant and a little bit nuts.
Compare that to his children's fiction, which often does not have a true villain, just people with conflicting interests.
Yeah. So those things all go into what made up the really polarizing reactions to Heinlein early on, pre-internet. Now, there's another big issue that comes up in Moorcock's essay Starship Stormtroopers, which really colored the way that he gets read by people on the political left, and particularly the way he got read by people on what was the new left in the 1960s. By the 1960s, it had become cemented in the popular educated mind that militarism and fascism were basically the same thing. Militarism, imperialism, and fascism are all just aspects of the same kind of thing. You can see this very strongly in the film adaptation of Starship Troopers, especially if you watch the commentary where Verhoeven says what he was trying to do was make a film that proves that war makes fascists of us all. It's a really popular idea, but from Heinlein's point of view, as someone who lived through both world wars, someone who was from the post-Reconstruction South and who was a liberal in the post-Reconstruction South, this was entirely wrong-headed. Heinlein did not like imperialism, and he hated fascism, and he had done everything he could to be involved in the war effort against both. And he had had a lot of friends that died in the war effort against both. And from his point of view, the notion that militarism, imperialism, and fascism are the same things was entirely misguided. He saw militarism as an aspect of any surviving civilization, a vital aspect of any civilization that has the capability of surviving against competing interests from other civilizations. The era post-World War II, which we are now at the end of, was the longest peaceful period in human history by about a factor of two. Before that, every 20 to 30 years, Europe had a continent-spanning conflict. The history of civilization is a history of countries blowing each other up and before that, invading each other and raping and killing each other. So post-World War II, as the peace settled in, war and imperialism got really conflated in the popular mind, and people stopped reading the Nazis, the Italian fascists, Russian history, Thucydides, all the deep history that gives you an idea of how these things actually wound up working, and things got reduced to a really simple war bad, peace good type of dichotomy. And in the post-World War II environment in the U.S., this was particularly interesting because the U.S., post-World War II, became an imperial power. But it became a weird kind of imperial power. The U.S. occupied the entire world and exercised imperial power militarily, but it didn't exercise it culturally. It didn't colonize. Before World War I, the U.S. had colonies. After World War I, it divested, and after World War II, it basically forced everyone else to divest. Colonialism was over, and so colonialism got seen as fascistic inherently, which it's not. It's a bit different. All of these things together created this massive gap between the way Heinlein thought about the world and the way that the boomer generation thought about the world. And that massive gap is reflected across the generations with the builder and the silent generations thinking about the world entirely differently than the boomers did. Which gets us to an explanation of how all of this got under Michael Moorcock's skin. Starship Stormtroopers, which is an essay by Michael Moorcock, arguing that Heinlein, Tolkien, and Richard Adams, the author of Watership Down, are all fascist on par with Hitler, and that their books are as dangerous as Mein Kampf, because all of them deal with themes of imperialism and aren't pacifistic. This particularly comes out in Starship Troopers. What Heinlein did with Starship Troopers was to create what he hoped would be a tract promoting the Western liberal tradition with as much gusto and rhetorical force as Mein Kampf promoted German fascism and Das Kapital and the Manifesto promoted communism. Heinlein saw the West as having a PR problem. There wasn't anyone except Ayn Rand promoting capitalism, and in Heinlein's way of thinking, capitalism is an epiphenomenon of liberalism. It's not the defining feature. In Heinlein's estimation, the individual voluntarily serving the community is the defining feature of liberalism, and the individual willing to put their life at risk for the good of the community against enemies, especially foreign enemies, was the most important thing to explore philosophically, because that was the tradition that he felt like was being lost in the post-war world. So if you read Starship Troopers with that in mind, what you realize he's doing is he's restating John Locke in incredibly provocative terms, with a bit of von Clausewitz and Sun Tzu mixed in. He's applying the logic of liberalism to the logic of survival. And that made a lot of people very uncomfortable because they had grown up in a world without war and where the prospect of war was nuclear war. It was the annihilation of all people, and every small conflict had the potential to become the world-ending conflict. And the last nearly world-ending conflict saw all of the governments, both on the good side and on the bad side, from their point of view, engaging in internment and carpet bombing and the mass destruction of civilians. But because they had no military history background, they lacked the ability to appreciate that all war has always involved those things, and it is the ability to object to them that is new. Three things make that ability possible. The first is the advance of technology to allow for the specific targeting of military infrastructure as opposed to civilian. It's a distinction that didn't exist before the end of World War II in any meaningful sense. It existed philosophically, but executing it was a big problem. The existence of the nuclear bomb changed the nature of war. It made war a great threat instead of a periodic paroxysm and spasm of unpleasantness that had to be endured. And the third thing that changed was the advance of communications technology, giving the people at home access to the battlefield. And in a place like America, that has this weird effect. Everywhere else in the world, the battlefield is the home front. especially in Europe, especially in Africa, and especially in the Middle East. The battlefield and the home front are the same thing. When wars happen, they happen in the streets of your hometown. That doesn't happen in America. So in America, you've got this weird cultural divide between the military class and everybody else. The military class, some of them go to war. They experience the horrors of war firsthand. The rest of us stay home, and we just see the casualty lists. And we've historically told ourselves stories about the glory of the battlefield and the wonders of martial virtue. Those are things that we borrowed from our European forebears, because those are parts of culture that you have to have if you're going to survive periodic wars in your front yard. But because America's are oceans away from any war front, there isn't the counterbalancing awareness of the horrors of war or a belief, a real belief in its occasional necessity. So the middle gets drained out, and it tends to get seen either as all good or all bad instead of as horrible but inevitable. The thing that Americans bring to the table is seeing war as optional, because in America, war is optional. Always has been. Even with the few wars that we've had on our own soil, it's largely been optional. It's only affected a very small part of the population because it's a big place. And when you combine that with the first generation in history to grow up without a major war, that's the boomers. Vietnam wasn't a major war. It was a very minor war. When you combine those things together, the baseline gets shifted, and war feels optional. And so you engage with talk of war and militarism and military history in much brighter categorical lines. Heinlein saw this as a mistake. In fact, he saw this as a civilization endangering mistake. And so he wrote Starship Troopers to try to put martial virtue in the Western context of public service in a broad context of public service, not in a narrow militaristic or imperialistic context. But that book fell on the ears of a generation that had never known war until it came in the form of Vietnam, and then because it came on television, they could see the horrors of war without understanding enough about the context to have an informed opinion on whether it was a good war. It wasn't a war for defense of the homeland. It wasn't a war that seemed necessary to anybody. It was a war that we engaged in because we basically owed Charles de Gaulle a favor. And the strategy that it was based on, the containment strategy, meant that it couldn't be fought properly, and it was doomed to be a failure, and that containment strategy didn't make sense to most people in the country. So even though the draft-to-volunteer ratio for Vietnam was way more favorable in the volunteer direction than any war in history, World War II included, the immediacy of the war to the people on the home front and the fact that the people on the home front had no active martial tradition anymore changed the entire way that that book was received. And so people that were from military families, who had been in the military, who had been in the intelligence services, or who were geopolitical wonks and understood the game theoretics of the Cold War, which most people didn't at the time, read that book and thought, oh, finally someone's saying it out loud. This is what we need. That's why it's still required reading at the Naval War College. It's the book that philosophically integrates the martial tradition into the public service tradition in American culture particularly. People who were not part of that tradition, who didn't have that background, read it and thought, oh my God, Heinlein's gone crazy. This is fascistic militaristic propaganda designed to help us take over the world. The irony is, of course, by the time Heinlein wrote Starship Troopers, he was no longer in favor of the West taking over the world because his travels had led him to believe that a one-world government could never work because the cultural differences between different people groups were so vast. So all of these things came together at the right time in history to make Heinlein a terribly polarizing figure. And at the same time, there were cultural revolutions going on and birth control and all sorts of stuff that made the liberal attitudes of the 1940s seem like reactionary attitudes later on. And Heinlein's attitudes themselves moved over the course of his life from sort of utopian socialist to a almost anarcho-libertarian stance because he lost his faith in the institutions to create justice. All of those things together make reading his entire corpus for an agenda or a message kind of confusing, because his ideology didn't stay the same over the course of his life, even though his values did. His basic, grouchy, disagreeable nature meant that he enjoyed provoking his readers as much as he enjoyed entertaining them, and his love of argument meant that he was always looking for a good fight. And that's why he and Harlan Ellison got along so well, because they had the same basic personality type, though Heinlein considered Harlan's public behavior rather rude, because Harlan was not a Southern gentleman. All of those things together made him sort of a man out of time after World War II wrapped up, and he never really reintegrated, but he was in an interesting catbird seat as a cultural critic. By the way, I've got a kudos for you. Your spotting of Manny as a dupe in Moon as a Harsh Mistress is really sharp, because he was. In fact, I believe at the end of the book, he even says so. I just listened to it again last year, and I was amazed. I had totally forgotten about that part of it. But, of course, that's another part of the way war works, is that the working-class engineering geniuses become the dupes of the intelligentsia and the military-industrial complex, represented respectively by Prof and Mike. So, there you go. It's one of the reasons that I love Heinlein as a writer is not just because I'm amazed by what he was able to do with his children's fiction, though that was what hooked me. It's that his stuff is amenable to reading on a number of levels all the time, and the more you know about his personal history and the history of the time in which he was writing, the more multi-layered and interesting his stuff becomes. He's not the only writer like that. Kurt Vonnegut is another one that writes like that. Phil Dick gets more interesting the older I get. There were a lot of really great writers that came out of the Builder and the Silent Generation that are just getting rediscovered now, whose writings are almost more relevant to the world as it sits now than they were to the time they were writing it. It's one of the delights of old books. Anyway, hope those of you who don't like Heinlein or aren't interested in intramural politics found this tolerable or skipped it entirely. And for the rest of you, thanks for sticking through. Thank you very much for the question, Ian. And I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.